All right. Hey, everybody, AJ's making a face at me.
That was great. I was along for the ride on that one. That was maybe my favorite intro of yours.
Was it? It was the best.
Yeah, surprise. You're like, oh, I guess this is a subdued episode. Nope. He's coming out strong.
Never, guys. I'll never let you down. Welcome back to another episode of the Coogan Chronicles podcast. What happens here, AJ?
This is the show where two former child actors interview other former child actors about growing up in the biz.
About growing up in the business, being on TV, getting recognized, making lots of money, burning through all that money. Yeah, doing all kinds of stuff. In fact, money is going to be a bit of our intro right now. We're going to talk about that a little bit. So you guys have clicked, obviously, on Lou Pucci's interview. Lou Pucci's an old friend of me and AJ's. We've hung out a lot. Lou and I have been to Burning Man. Lou's a big Burning Man guy. I hated Burning Man. I left early. But we didn't talk about that with Lou. We talked about all kinds of stuff we didn't know about Lou and Lou's past life as a former kid actor. We met Lou when he was an adult. But Lou mentioned a little something interesting in our episode, which we won't elaborate on too much. But he talked about how the money he had to spend transporting himself to New York from Jersey to go on auditions and to work as an actor, as a kid actor. And I did the same thing. Him and I were both going in and out of the Port Authority bus terminal as kids from Jersey, going into New York auditioning. And
everyone says Port Authority bus terminal. I have no idea what that is. What is the Port Authority bus terminal?
It's the butthole of New York. That's what it is. It's the most disgusting place on the planet. It's literally just, it's a bus terminal like for buses that go all over the East Coast and I'm sure travel all the way across the United States.
I'm so glad you said that, because everybody that knows what it is, they're picturing the butthole of New York in their heads. And I'm just picturing this ambiguous nothing place. So now it's so much more specific.
It honestly is so dark and grungy and gross. Like, there isn't a picture. And granted, this is 20 years ago, 25 years ago. I've been in New York countless times since. And as an adult, I don't think I've ever even sniffed the Port Authority bus terminal again. Thank God. No, there's train stations actually in there. So there's probably people have probably gone through that quite often. And I don't know if they've redone it. I really hope to God they did. Because I'm pretty sure I saw dead bodies growing up, like in the Port Authority bus terminal. I'm positive. Because there was two things I remember about the Port Authority. One, dead bodies. And two, getting comic books at a little newsstand for my bus rides. That was it. That was the whole thing. And I think I got those comic books so my mom made sure I didn't look at the dead bodies lying about.
I think the equivalent for me driving back and forth from Las Vegas, which is where my family was living when I made the jump to Los Angeles, and we would drive back and forth, is the Barstow little off to get gas and In-N-Out Burger, and that place is terrible.
Oh, that's
well.
Rough.
Probably a lot better than the Port Authority bus terminal, but still not great.
Absolutely. I mean, if you got the smell of In-N-Out, you're doing all right. There was a smell of like black plague inside the Port. It was just like, it was death. I'm telling you, it was death in there, for sure. I'm sure if you Google like how many people have died in the Port Authority, they're like, how numbers can range from 5,000 to 5 million. We don't know. You know? Yeah. It's funny. Transportation.
But you had a point here, Chris.
Yes, I had a point, but I also did want to notice too. Yeah, if I wasn't in the Port Authority, my mother and I were stuck in traffic in the Lincoln Tunnel going back to Jersey for about 3 hours for
it's got to be like 70% of your time as a child actor is stuck in a car to and from auditions, or stuck on a train to and from auditions, right?
Absolutely is. It absolutely is. Unless you're like somehow living in the Mecca, unless you're, you know, you're like, I live in Times Square on 43rd Street, you know, or you're like, I live in Hollywood just below the sign. Like that's, yeah, then you're traveling. But that travel costs money, right? And it definitely does. And that was the point of today's intro, because Lou mentioned that. He mentioned, you know, the bus ticket he had to buy. And now at a certain point, you know, that really played into his mindset, you know, going to and from auditions and getting or not getting jobs. And we'll let him elaborate on that. But for us, we just wanted to point out, we realized like we don't talk much about how much money people spend to get their kids into show business and how quickly cash can get burned. We're talking like tens of thousands of dollars can get burned up in like a 6 month period, a 3 month period.
It's a huge industry out here in Los Angeles and all over the country, but in Los Angeles in particular, between headshots to haircuts, to coaching, to audition prep, just one audition, you could spend like $100 getting coached. Just for one audition.
Just for an audition,
you have multiple auditions a week, and your agent's encouraging you. Yeah, you should get coached. You should do that. And I mean,
get coached, get the haircut. Insane.
Like the apartment in Oakwood, the furnished apartment in Oakwood was like, what, $3,000 for a one-bedroom apartment there?
And
that
honestly,
was then. Who knows what it costs now?
Who knows what it is now? And you, if anyone not in the know, you're paying for like a barely better Motel 6. Like it is there's nothing, there's no bells and whistles. You go in there and you're like, they have not changed these carpets in 25 years. And, you know, and you can definitely smell whatever was getting cooked in that kitchen prior to you moving in. Like there's, it's not glorious. And you can, I think the rent, at least when I was there, was like at least $3,000 or $3,500. And that's just a two bedroom, tiny little place, you know, that's furnished. Like that's crazy numbers nowadays. That's 20 years, 20 some odd years ago. That's like triple the number of what it should have been.
And it's all in the hopes of booking a commercial or booking a guest star, or maybe you get a series regular part on a television show, or maybe you're the 1 in 1 million chance that books Star Wars or something like Jake Lloyd did. But most of the time, maybe you make a couple of bucks or something like that, but you're outlaying tens of thousands of dollars to give this thing a try.
Yeah.
I mean, Los Angeles must love child actors.
Of course they do.
They just suck the money.
Are you kidding me? There's so many people lurking about all over Los Angeles that are, especially now that's the internet.
Oh, you should come to this acting class.
Exactly. I'm telling you, there's so many people out there and they're just going to, and they will suck people dry. And I don't know, man, maybe it works. I mean, you went to one of those types of things.
I went to acting class. I got headshots. I stayed at open apartments. We spend all that money and it worked out.
You got the TV show. You did the thing. Your life changed. You've been in LA ever since. Like that's what happened. I was thinking about the first time I ever went out to LA from Jersey, and we went out with three other kid actors. We all shared two apartments, but girls on one side, boys on the other. It was horrible. My mom and this kid, Scott Gerbasia's mom, shared a room. God knows what that was about. That was like two grown adults that are like, okay, we'll just put good night, you know, and saying good night to each other. And me and Scott shared a room. Anyway, we went out there. We spent months. We spent, every dollar we had. And we had to rent this expensive car because, my mom barely drove. So we took taxis, which in LA is absolutely insane. Who takes a taxi to Santa Monica and back, you know? So we spent all this money. And at the end of it, I booked this national Toyota commercial. And it was a huge deal because, like, it's a national commercial. It's going to run everywhere. You're going to make hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then, like, they scrapped it. We filmed it.
Yeah, right.
It never happened. Right. And it was like we spent all this money. We thought, oh, we hit the lottery. And then we went back like, okay, well, back to ground zero. No rollerblades for you guys this Christmas. You know, it's like there was we went without for like a sec because we did.
But
we
yet it also worked out for you. You did all this stuff. The family moved. I mean, but it all worked out. But there's so many for every story like that. There's what? I mean, 1,000, 2,000 more stories of it not working out. It's just like thousands. Whatever for 20, let's say on average, I wonder what that number is on average for a young person that pursues acting. What is it? $20,000? What's the average?
Oh, that seems high. I think if you really wanted to, you could spend $20,000. I think probably
just the people that try it.
I think just try it. You're going to spend somewhere between maybe $1,500 to $5,000. You're going to spend somewhere in that range.
If you do a month at Oakwood, one pilot season, you've spent $15,000.
I guess going full throttle, going to LA for a second and auditioning for a couple months.
Not your local town.
$10,000. You're going to spend $10,000. You're going to spend around $10,000. That's probably it. But maybe not. I don't know. I did one acting class for about 3 weeks and I was like, get me the fuck out of here. Like, that's it. You know, so I don't know, like, if you're in there every week or multiple classes or like, you know, there's a lot of kids that are like, they're like, I'm going to do dance. I'm going to do ballet. I'm going to do fencing. I'm going to do rock climbing. I'm going to do, you know, it's right. Like there's, you know, you can really go nuts with it too. So
that's so true. The other thing is, so let's say you make some money. It's not like it's all going to your college fund, let's say, because remember, there's an adult that has to go everywhere with you all day long. They can't have their job. It's like, it's impossible unless you want to, like you guys did, hire somebody to be your chaperone when you have to pay that person too. So, I mean, you can't just book a commercial. Like, you have to make a full living. You have to be supporting a family because it takes multiple people to be dedicated to this one cause. It's crazy.
That's very true. Yeah, it really is crazy. It's nuts. And Lou Pucci breaks down his really fascinating, wonderful story with us. It's awesome. It was awesome to get to know our very close buddy like this in this context and for him to share so much about his life. Guys, he's super charming. So without further ado...
And we're here with our good buddy Lou Pucci. Lou, how's it going, man?
What's up, Lou?
Ooh, I'm going good. How you doing?
Good. Good, man.
We were just saying how weird it is having our really good pals on the show, because we talk all the time and then we come on the show and it's like we have to have some sort of official conversation or introduce you or something like that. It's always a bit bizarre.
It's really official.
Oh, you're going to see, Lou. Yeah. This is
you're
going to
see how official this gets. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
No, it's good, man. It's going to be nice. I think we're really excited to learn about, you know, as well as we've known you as an adult, to learn about you as a, and your like life as a kid actor. We know barely anything. You just sort of, you came into our view and our peripheral and our social circle when we were all adults. So,
right.
You know, yeah, your whole story is unknown to us. So it's going to be really interesting to explore.
This is kind of a thing, right? Like when you have romantic relationships in your life, you will talk to that person about their past and you'll learn about their childhood and their family and where they come from. With your friends, it's like, well, if we didn't experience it together, I don't care. I don't care about your past.
I guess if it was a friend who was outside of the business completely and didn't understand the industry, you might tell them a whole bunch of shit that they'd be really excited about. But for some reason, when it's people who are your friends from in the industry, you think it wouldn't be cool to share that information, or it's weird to, or maybe even you're bragging or some shit. Like there's just a weird thing surrounding it all of like, what do I tell the people who I'm closest to who share this same industry? Cause I don't know. I've never shared any of this stuff with any of my friends who are in the industry before. And that's really weird.
Yeah. There's a line there with a lot of actors where you just don't really talk about acting, your experience acting. I mean, you talk about when you do a job or you're traveling somewhere in particular, but other than that, it's, everything's just sort of like, yeah, everybody deals with it. You deal with it solo.
I think also being older, like now I'm more comfortable with myself, comfortable in my own skin to be able to talk about that stuff. And like, it just feels like history of my history rather than something so personal. It's just kind of a story that you can tell.
I think that's a good point. And that's something Chris and I have talked about now is the ability of time and space to look back on this stuff in a way that allows you to explore it without that extreme emotional connection to it, but in a more retrospective type way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For you, when you think about all your experiences growing up acting, how tangible are those memories for you? Do they feel really distant and like disconnected from you? Or do you actually feel very like they're still a part of you?
I think that there's been a lot of weird times I've gone through. Like around 27 or somewhere around there, I had a major shift where I started to feel like I was back on the road to being me again. I felt like me at 15 to 17 was my most true me. And then somewhere around there, things kind of got wonky because all this new stuff was introduced and I started doing real big professional films and stuff. And not that I lost myself, but that I was now referring to my old self in the third person. I was no longer like that same kid. I was now being introduced to so many new things. I didn't know who I was anymore. And then somewhere around 10 years later, somewhere around 27 to 30, I started realizing like, oh no, I remember that kid. And I think I am that kid again. I just had to take this real big circle around to get back to it.
I want to give context to it. Explain to us prior to 15 what your relationship was to acting and how you got into it and what you were doing.
Yeah, I did. So, I mean, there's a lot there, but to summarize it, I ended up in Sound of Music on Broadway when I was like 12. And that was, you know, a major crazy change in my life that once I got to like high school after that, I was just hoping that this wasn't the coolest thing I ever did in my life. And I was going to a regular high school, actually not a regular one, but like an all boys Christian high school that was very pre-collegiate. So it was like actually kind of upscale, lots of rich kids, lots of, you know, C++ computer programming type classes, like weird shit that was made for people who were like headed for college and wanted to have a, you know, couple of these things done before they got there.
Were you an outsider there? Were you like, like, hey guys, I just came off the Sound of Music on Broadway. What's up with this computer programming you're all busy with?
So I was just so stupid, man. Sound of Music gave us a backpack that had like the Sound of Music symbol on it. And I thought it was cool and I wore it in high school. And man, was that a bad idea?
Not in Jersey. You don't wear that shit in Jersey, dude.
And I would get the, you know, homo sign on my back while I was walking down the hall. It'd be literally, a lot of kick me and shit like that in my freshman year.
Lou, it would probably be important for people to understand too, a little bit of like your background with your family and how you wound up. Because I want to ask the question, why your parents sent you to this Christian high school, knowing that you're a performing arts kid. And they, I know that they supported you in your endeavors as a performing arts kid. So maybe having a little context there, a little background, what the family dynamic was like and how you guys started and the support system and stuff would help give context here.
Yeah, it's a hard question to answer because it seems like strangely really well thought through and at the same time not well thought through at all for my parents. Like they knew I was doing this stuff. They knew they wanted me to do this stuff. They named me my name because they thought it would be a good musician's stage name because my dad is a musician. So Lou Taylor Pucci was supposed to be like a musician stage name. And so they, from the beginning, knew what they wanted me to do and knew where they wanted me to go. So like to send me to a pre-collegiate type school like that, that's all boys, not very creative at all. It ended up being the perfect thing for me in some ways because I don't know, I guess if it was like now and I got to go to like a Montessori school or something like that, where people were like, hey, just do what you want when you want to, you know, and then just learn what you want. If you want to do music, do music. I probably would have survived really well there. But for this, it gave me this massive limitation of nobody in this school is creative. Everyone is going to go try to work on Wall Street with their parents and do what their parents did. So I am the outsider, and it made me kind of claw my way through it and be creative in one way or another. But it also made me like stretch that other side of my brain that would be business side or math side and all this stuff that usually actors just don't give a shit about if they do go to an art school. Or a school that even is liberal arts or cares about art at all. Our music program was shit. We had no art class whatsoever. Like our big, you know, we all had religion classes. I mean, like it was a weird school for an artist to go to.
It's amazing all of the different stories we've heard of people, you know, young actors going to every different type of school you could possibly imagine. And this experience that you're describing is the first one that we've heard of in this capacity as well. I do want to go back to your time on Sound of Music because I just want to hear about, you know, being your first job and what that whole experience was like, never having done anything before. So Lou, why don't you take us, if you could, why don't you take us back to the beginning, like your first experience with acting? How did this even come into your life?
Yeah. First thing that happened was my aunt and my mom, they bribed me to do something. They thought I watched too much Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I was 10 years old. And they were like, you know, do something, just get up off the couch. And I could either, they gave me two options. They said, you're either going to be an altar boy at church, or you can go audition for theater. So I was an altar boy for 6-7 months because I was like, I'm not doing theater. There's just no way. That's, you know, my parents put musicals in front of me my whole life. So I didn't really think about acting as anything except musicals. And I was like, I don't want to do that gay shit. I was just a kid who was like afraid of doing anything that was like out of the norm. So, you know, at first it was weird. I didn't want to do it myself, but they pushed me toward it. I auditioned for something, an Oliver show at in my grandma's town, Sayreville, New Jersey. And it was a community theater production. And I went in there and I did my audition and I had a really high voice and they wanted me to sing and dance. And I had never done any of those things. And then it was like a cattle call-y type audition. It lasted all day. By the end of the day, they had me auditioning for Oliver. And I was called down into the basement to go like do the audition in front of like 25 different people in a semicircle. And I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, this is
so scary. And you've never acted in your life. You just show up and now you're.
No. And I didn't do well. I had never read lines in my life. I thought I was there to like sing and dance. And then all of a sudden they're having me go like, please, sir, can I have some more? And I'm like, I don't know if that was really selling. I don't know.
Do you remember exactly the impetus for your mom and aunt to do this was really just because they felt like you were watching too much TV? Were they just trying to get the place?
It was that, and they treated us. I have two brothers and a sister, and we were like dolls. We would be dressed in the same sailor suit type clothes for my entire childhood until finally I rebelled at 10 years old. I was like, Dad, I'm not wearing the hat.
I'm not wearing the damn sailor hat again. She can dress the two of them, but not me.
And they were dressing you like that to sort of give you the appearance of like.
No, I think my mom liked having kids. She just liked having kids and liked having little dolls mm-hmm. and dressing them up and shit. And so like, I thought this was one of those things too, when they were pushing me toward theater. It was like, oh, mom wants me to do theater and sing a dance and I don't want to do that shit. And so I didn't, you know, I tried not to for a while.
Well, you mentioned earlier too, you said something about like your parents gave you your name to be a famous musician's name or a stage name. Your dad did. So they approached it. So you were set up before you were, as you were yeah. just conceived, the right. idea was this kid's going to become a performer of some kind and we're going to help him do that.
My first memory ever is my father up on a stage at a county fair playing guitar. And then they're dropping a screw below the deck and me having to crawl under the deck to try and find this thing. And I felt so helpful. And I was like, oh, this is cool. Like, so, I don't know, someday I'll be on stage or something like that. Like, this is what you do when you grow up. And he's playing guitar and he's singing and all that stuff. So there was definitely that knowledge or that weird feeling of self-fulfilling prophecy that like, I will end up doing this someday. But my parents also had it and they built it in. They were like,
was your mom a performer as well?
She did modeling when she was younger. She was like Miss, I think her sister was Miss New Jersey at one point or something like that. They all did a little bit of modeling and stuff.
Was there a feeling of being groomed sort of for this life in acting?
It never felt that way. If they were doing that the whole time, it was beyond me.
If they were really good at it. If they were doing that, they were yeah. really good at it.
They kept giving me constant choice to do this or not do this or try something like kind of that might be boring, like altar boy
you
at church.
You can be an altar boy.
You can be an altar boy or go up on stage and receive lots of attention.
Yeah, exactly. Actor, so I was like altar boy for a long time.
Yeah, that's so funny. And by the way, we named you so that you could be up on stage. We thought it'd be a good movie star name.
And you also have this aspirational thing going on in your mind too, because your father's a musician. You look up to your father and you see him on stage. And so you're thinking you're being encouraged to do performing arts in a very positive way, it seems. But then you also have this aspirational idea surrounding the performing arts, looking up to your father being a guitar player and stuff.
Yeah, that's it. That's my life, man. And then what happened next was I started doing a couple of community theater productions where I was in the ensemble cast and I was just like a Fagin's boy in Oliver. And I was in all the scenes, you know, we had to learn quick changes and, you know, all this stuff. And it was really fun because there was two sides to me. I was like a schizophrenic. I felt like I had one side, which was the extremely shy kid in a Catholic regular elementary school. And then there was the kid who was allowed to fully let loose and be like huge and loud and stupid and silly and sing and dance and be ridiculous at theater after school. So I had these friends from there and a couple of friends from regular school. And I was just two different people at all times.
Yeah, I can totally relate to that. My whole childhood was a double life. I was like a 007 agent going because yeah. I was in Jersey as well. And I would go into New York and work and all day I would be right. doing something. And then I'd go back to Jersey, see some friends, play a baseball game, go back to school the next day. And it's like nothing happened and nobody had any idea. And if I dare bring anything up, I was just like, right. I mean, I got the shit kicked out of me. I was ridiculed. Like nobody wanted to hear that stuff. You know, I was like, you know, yesterday I sang The Little Mermaid for this audition. They're like, no, we don't right. want to hear it, Chris.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you get picked last for dodgeball.
So true. And they were all such naysayers because they were all so scared of that stuff. You know what I mean? Yeah. Everything was fag this, fag that. If they did hear about it, it was very judged, way overjudged.
Well, Jersey, I think probably in that time you and I grew up in Jersey, there was, I don't know what it's like today. I haven't lived in Jersey in a long time, but central Jersey where I lived, it was this culture of young men where it was all about professional sports and being super macho, and that was it.
Yeah, so just trying to like, diminish your masculinity at any cost, exactly. Like at any moment, cost. Just take it down. So
exactly, and you were an easy target if you were like, I'm a soft-hearted performer who loves to be vulnerable and expose my emotions in enthusiastic ways.
they're like,
we didn't ever was taken too seriously. Yeah,
was the feeling. It was constant.
How do you make this leap from community theater to being in a Broadway musical?
the logic of it goes, I did a couple of community theater shows. There was this little girl who was probably about 8 or 9 years old that my mom was always trying to do some networking, probably like behind the scenes. I never felt it, but she was always talking to everybody else. I'd be like, "Mom, stop talking about all this crap. They're my friends, you know?" And then she talked to this girl's mom and was like, "Hey, I know your daughter does commercials. How did she get into it?" And she said, "Well, we found representation in New York." And my mom said, who is it? Could we like talk to her or him?" And she said, "Yeah, her name is Shelley and she's really great for us. And she's been getting us commercial auditions. Like we could ask." And then they asked and Shelley came back and was like, "Could he sing over the phone for me? And I'll tell him whether he could come into New York and meet me or not." So I sing through the telephone some Oliver stuff to Shelley. And she's like, "All right, come into New York." So we have a trip into New York City. I do a Smucker's, you know, commercial for her, which is like the general thing everybody was doing at that time.
Yeah, we all read the Smucker's commercials. Smucker's an agent to read the Smucker's commercials. Yeah.
Smucker's it is. And so I did that a couple times and sang for her. And she said, "Okay, I'll represent you." It wasn't super professional, but to me, it was blowing my mind. I couldn't believe I was going out for things. The first thing she did was try to get me an agent.
Does this still feel like living your mother's dream out, or like has it started to become your dream and your
goal? Oh yeah, I mean, seriously, it was also a way out. I mean, at 17, when I did get a big film, I instead of going to college, I flew to Oregon, and I was experiencing my college basically alone on my own terms with no rules as the main character of a film with like Keanu Reeves and
so you were
D'Onofrio and all these people. So it was like, I was living the absolute life. It didn't feel like her life or my dad's life at all.
You got planted with the vision early on of, "Oh, this is my way out. I can see the road here."
More than that, it had to do with money. From the very, very beginning, my family felt like, if there was an argument between my parents, it was always about money because there was never enough money. My dad worked a blue collar, manual labor type job as a manager of a screen printing corporation in New Jersey. My mom was a stay at home mom for 4 kids. It never felt like we had what we needed. It was always like just overly trying to get more money through the house. And I felt like this need, I had this super Jesus-y savior complex. I don't know, as the first kid, as like the one who was given a lot of attention to. It was like
too much time at Catholic school.
Yeah, whatever it was, it definitely, well, honestly, in truth, I definitely, I thought of Jesus as this character who was like a magician and this like magical being that could save the world. And like, can't I be like that? And in school, I asked that question. I was like, "Can I be Jesus?" And they were like, "No." I said, "What? Then what are we doing this for? Like, what are we praying all the time for? What's the point of all this shit?" And they were like, "Well, you have original sin. You're not allowed to be Jesus. You just got to worship Jesus."
You're 10 years old and you see this stuff going on in your household and you've got a savior complex.
Yeah, totally.
And you're motivated to continue pursuing. You seem to really enjoy acting, but you're motivated to continue to pursue it professionally because you feel like financially it could really help the household.
Because at 12 years old, when I do end up auditioning for agents, get an agent, and then within 3 months get Sound of Music on Broadway, I end up getting paid more than my dad is getting paid at the time and bringing that money into the house, even though most of that money went to ridiculous things that it needed to go to, which was like my transportation, because I had to live in New Jersey and transport myself with my parents to New York. Then my mom would come home. And then she'd come back to get me. And so we would spend like $450 a week just on the bus tickets to get to and from New York. So all that
Port
money.
Authority bus terminal.
Yeah, the Port Authority bus terminal, man.
I did the same thing. It sounds like maybe there was this amalgamation of your parents were artistic and your dad's a musician and they give you this name so that it could resonate with audiences in some way. And then also they say, "Hey, look, we're going to sign you up for this cattle call audition for Oliver in some shady basement somewhere in New York. Let's come on, Lou, we're going to give you $10 if you go." And then you see your dad at a fair and you say, "Oh my God, I love watching my dad. I'd love to do something like that too." And then you hear that your parents are struggling financially or are always seemingly worried about money. And so you see that maybe you can help provide. You're in a Catholic school and you think to yourself, well, maybe I'll be an actor and be the sort of Jesus to my family as a successful actor.
That's what it sounds like to me.
That's what it sounds like to me too. So I'm just trying to get all the pieces and put them into the puzzle that is Lou Taylor Pucci. And then all that happens, and almost immediately out of the gates, you get this agent and you're on Broadway and you're in the Sound of Music, and suddenly you're showing up on a stage in New York for a theater probably filled with what, at least 1,500 people or
1,200 people. Yeah.
1,200 people. Yeah.
Old Martin Beck Theater.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So you're at the Martin Beck and now you're performing, and you were, my guess is you did it for at least a year or something, right?
Yeah. I was in it for about a year and a half. I think I was like, maybe end of being 11 until somewhere in the middle of 13.
And what was that work schedule like, Lou, doing the Sound of Music?
It was not what it is today. Now they have A and B group kids. And at that time, they just did not give a shit. And so I was doing 8 shows a week at 12 years old, probably the same thing you were doing, Chris, but like it was nuts. I had to go back to school in New Jersey every Monday to Friday. I couldn't go to school on Wednesday because there was a matinee and another show. So I would have to make up all the work in the 2 hours before I'd get on the bus on Thursday. I would get home at 1 a.m, go to school at 7 a.m. Monday was our dark day for Broadway. So every single day I was working or going to school. So there was literally no day off.
There's no break. There's no break.
For a year and a half.
Chris and I opened our podcast in our first episode talking about the child labor laws in the country. Yeah. And just hearing you talk about this is like, oh my God, that's crazy.
It's insane. But at that time, when you're a kid, you really don't know. At least I didn't notice that it was a lot of work. I thought it was just what you're supposed to. It was like my duty.
This is why kids make the best workers, because they don't even know that it's a lot of work.
I don't know you're a slave. Yeah, you just don't know.
It is very funny. So then, you know, as we looked at your career, right, you go from, it seems like your career's taken really big jumps. And so you go from community theater to Broadway, and then Broadway, and as you mentioned a few minutes ago, like the star of a big indie film with huge major movie stars.
Right. And yeah, that took a few years between. Like, I just had this feeling like I don't want to lose the fact that I am a child and I want to experience child things. I talked to AJ about this once, but basically like what I grew up at the time when Home Alone was the biggest thing in the world. And then Macaulay Culkin's parents, whatever, like it came out in the news that they took all his money or that his money wasn't given to Macaulay Culkin or something. And something bad happened to that kid. And so it felt like my parents were always wary of this experience and constantly trying to make sure that I never thought that my money or that anything I did was taken from me or that was used in a weird, wonky way or that they were in any way taking advantage of my doing this stuff or that I was working in some way for them. So it provided this weird safety net constantly of like me knowing I don't want to be this kid that like gets out of school early and, you know, gets my diploma early in order to go to Los Angeles and just start acting. Cause then I'll have no experiences as a kid to actually relate to when I'm an adult. Something in me was just like, I want to go to prom and I want to do the things that people make movies about.
Yeah. That's something I know about you as an adult too. You've always been thoughtful about living your life and not allowing the entertainment industry to completely consume you like it easily can. But I did want to ask you, you had this idea that you wanted to help provide for your family and bring additional money into the household. Is that something you ever shared with your parents? Were they aware that you felt that way?
I don't think so. I don't think that they ever thought that I had any stress about that specifically. Yeah, I never talked about it with them. I think it was just something that was going on in me constantly. And whenever, you know, honestly, I did end up quickly having to do things like this, where I would be on an interview and people would ask me, even at like 13 years old, because I'm on Broadway or something and the New Jersey paper wants to like do a, you know, interview. And they would say, why are you doing this? And I would say, honestly, you know, my parents always fought about money. And like, I just honestly feel I know.
Well, I'm sure then they read these things.
They never talked to me about it and said like, hey, are you really worried about this? They never did that. Yeah. And I don't know whether that would have been good or bad or what, but it never became a thing that we talked about.
Well, when you said like, you know, you go do a Broadway show and you're 12 and 13 years old and suddenly you're making more money than your dad does. When you said, do you mind me asking, like, what did that reflect itself in your home life? Did your home life change? Did your relationship with your dad change? Do you think that had any real bearing or effect on your whole family?
I feel like I never wanted anything. I could always have anything I wanted, basically. Like, if I wanted, hey, dad, I want to get a new TV, it'd be like, here we go. So, like, money went to the house, but it also went to me in whatever way that I wanted it to. It didn't get put away in some kind of an account or anything like that. But in terms of the psychology of it, of living in the house, I would say, no, it didn't really have any bearing. I mean, I may have gotten a little bit of a big head at times where I was like, I remember making fun of my dad. I remember actually making fun of my dad at one point, being like, I make more money than you. And he was cracking up. Like, we're laughing our asses off. I know it was like kind of dick, but he was happy about it. Like, he was like, good. Because the truth was, he at 13, he did make me go work in his shop, his screen printing shop, which was filled with like people who were just doing manual labor all day, every day for the rest of their fucking lives. And he was like, I'm making you do this for these 3 months of your summer so that you know what you don't want to do with your life. Because this is not what you want to do with your life. You want to use your brain, or you want to use your talent somehow, and you want to do something. So he was excited constantly that I was doing this stuff. And maybe somewhere in there was some kind of a jealousy, but I never felt anything like that. I never felt that at all. I think that's just really was nice. Happy that I got to do the things that he wanted to do.
Well, yeah, because there is that thing for, you know, a lot of adults, like in your father's case, and my father too was a musician as well, but your dad being a musician and having aspirations to be very successful at it and having a family and then, you know, getting serious and needing to provide, and you've had the opportunity to really pursue your artistic endeavors for your whole adult life and make it your main pursuit. Does that ever come up in the topic of conversation in the family, that, you know, just the difference there, or is it just maybe unspoken?
It's mostly unspoken. It really is, because my dad is still doing the things, he's still going toward the things that he likes doing too, which is music. He's in a, like, Crosby, Stills and Nash cover band that plays at festivals all across the country and stuff. And so he keeps that stuff alive now in his later years. He gave it up for like 25 years. At a certain point, when I was about 6, I remember him bringing me into his room and saying, we have no fucking money and I got to sell a bunch of my guitars. Which one should I keep? And so that was an emotional experience that I always remembered. And like that kind of stuff, it affected my whole life. And that memory I'll always have of the sadness that he had to go through in order to have what he wanted, because the truth is, he really did want a family. My dad's experience was always a really inspirational story to me, because his experience was so weird. He ran away from home at like 15 because his dad died at 10, and his mom married a, you know, stepdad that was kind of a piece of shit to him when he was a kid. And so he ran away and started playing music and guitar because his real father had given him a record collection when he was a kid and a guitar. And so that was the last thing he had from his dad. And so he decided to sort of run toward that. He ran away and he joined bands. And somewhere in him, even though he really wanted to make it and he wanted to go to Hollywood and he wanted to be like a musician and all this stuff, there was another part of him that really wanted a good family. And he wanted to create a good family because his family was destroyed when he was a kid. He wanted to be a good dad. And so in a way, when he wanted to marry my mom, he had a decision to make. He was either going to move to Hollywood right then, or my mom was going to say yes and marry him. And my mom finally said yes at the third time, and they got married and had kids. And he basically gave up that other dream.
Wow. The motivation for both you and your father is so clearly defined. Unpacking that stuff, it's so clearly defined.
It is pretty incredible that your endeavor to be an actor, you know, feels like it's a generational fulfillment, that it comes not just from your own ambitions, but tied to your father's ambitions in life and your relationship with your dad. So then, do you mind me asking, so then as you really start to solidify as a young man, okay, I'm an actor, this is what I want to do, it's not music, it's not dancing, it's, you know, your life, you're still in New Jersey, you're going in and out of New York, I imagine, to audition and work and keep pursuing it. Do things change as you start to get older, or does it just feel like one fluid thing for you? Like what happens after Sound of Music ends?
I think everybody told me, hey man, as you get older, this is going to get harder. So keep going. Because somebody was giving me that good advice. I remember that kind of advice, like, hey, this is going to get a lot harder. You're going to be a small fish in a big pond of people who are all the same age trying to act at some point. So take advantage of this being a kid stuff, because everybody wants a kid actor to be in their movies because people are kids for only so long. So yeah. I got that understanding and I was like, all right, fine. I'll start auditioning again, because I had taken off after Sound of Music and I was like, I just want to be a high school kid. And then somewhere in about middle of sophomore year, I started auditioning again. And I was like, okay, I'll go to New York. And each time that I would go to New York, it would be like $50 to spend just for the transportation to and from New York. So it was kind of felt like a wound on the family that they were giving up something each time that I went. And that if I didn't come back with a job, I felt like I was hurting the family more than anything else. So it was like there really was a very tangible feeling of either success or failure.
But for you, it didn't seem like it was that hard for that long. I mean,
it felt like shit for a year of that time, from sophomore to junior year. I got nothing, not one. I mean, I got a lot of auditions, but I got no callbacks, no nothing. And then finally this one thing came along, and the last thing I had done is Sound of Music. So I knew I could, you know, sing and dance and march on a stage and that kind of shit. But I did not think I could be in a like independent film about, I remember calling my dad and being like, hey, so there's this audition that came in. I don't think I'm going to go in for it into New York. And he was like, what is it? Why? I said, cause he's supposed to be this kid who's tortured and he's been a slave in somebody's basement or something. And then a girl finds him and picks him up as a hitchhiker. And she like takes his shirt off and he's got all these whipping marks on his back and he's crying and she's trying to save him. And I don't know what the hell this is. This is so weird. And he was like, that's why you have to do it. Go into New York and do this. So I was scared shitless. And then I go in and it turns out that Rebecca Miller, who is the director, and Rebecca Miller, I didn't know this. I didn't know anything about her. But in the end, in retrospect, I'm looking at it. It's like it couldn't have been a cooler person to have an audition with, because she's Arthur Miller's daughter, married to Daniel Day-Lewis, and an artist herself and an actress. So she's in the room of this first audition that I go to. And the only action in the story was I had very little lines and I just had to be crying and picking my nails and not looking anyone in the eye. It was a very...
Sounds like my nightmare, Lou. This sounds like my worst
nightmare. It was scary as shit. But something in it, because Rebecca was so good at asking questions of me and saying like, well, what do you feel like it would be like? If I asked a question like, should I do this or should I do that? She would make me make the decision, even in the first audition. And it just made me understand what acting was for the first time in the room of an audition. And I came out of that room going like, holy shit, I just transported to an emotional place where I was this kid for a second. And it really screwed me up. And I'm like kind of crying right now. And I don't know what to do. And now I have to go see my mom in the waiting room. And I'm like, Jesus. I don't know what just happened.
Is your mom? Do you come out and is your mom going, oh my God, Lou, are you okay? Or like what happened? Do you remember?
I think I hit it kind of well. And then we went home and, you know, a couple days later, they just gave me the part. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy. So then I go into Rebecca Miller and I say, hey, so you know, first rehearsal or whatever, I say, who is this kid? And she's like, well, who do you think he is? I'm like, oh God. So she really made me do work.
Oh God, did you write a script, Rebecca? Oh, just tell me what happened.
I know. Just tell me.
You have this audition experience and it's somewhat traumatizing, right? I mean, you're emotional afterwards. You've never experienced something like
positive
this.
Positive trauma.
But you're a teenager, and so it's just a traumatic thing. But then you get the job, and it's this life affirming moment where you've fulfilled, you know, a year's worth of hard work of auditioning, and you have this moment. Were you then able to correlate that feeling that you had, that semi traumatic feeling associated with doing a good audition or a good emotional performance, with good things happening? Did your brain then link those two things?
I mean, I now knew what it was to be deeply inside a character, or like trick my body into being in such actual trauma, whether it was from the fear of going to that audition that I just used or whatever it was, that I tricked myself for the first time ever into actually feeling like I was a different person. And now I equated that feeling with acting. And that blew my mind. And that was kind of like being really spoiled as an actor, because I don't think a lot of people have that experience and know what that is from an early age. Because usually you just learn entertainment, you learn singing and dancing, you learn like putting on a show for somebody, but not actually getting in somebody's head and being a different person and sincerely trying to express that you are that thing and feeling like you are that thing, tricking yourself into thinking you are that thing. And that blew my mind.
And so, and Lou, this is for Personal Velocity, right?
Yeah, that's Personal Velocity, it was called.
And so do you feel like, do you still feel like a kid at this point? Or is this the moment where you go, oh, I'm an, you know, an adult actor now? Or do you still feel like a kid?
No, I'm a kid. I still didn't even get the script in the mail. I mean, they wouldn't even give me a script. I only had my scenes. So like I really had no idea what the hell I was doing. And then we're going up to the Catskills. And then Daniel Day-Lewis is on the set. I don't know who he is. He's got his kid and he's like talking to my dad and having these scenes with Firuza Balk, who's like a badass. She's super funny. And I'm playing this kid who's crying and picking his nails and got all these like, you know, scabs and blood on his, you know, all this weird special effects makeup on my back and stuff. And it was just one of the weirdest experiences I ever had. And that was only a week. And then I go back to school and I'm back in school again. And there's no movie anymore. And I never hear anything about it for almost 2 years. And I can't get another job. And I'm auditioning again for another year and a half, getting absolutely nothing. And then finally, randomly, we hear in the newspaper that there's this festival called Sundance and that somehow Personal Velocity won the grand jury prize at Sundance. We don't know what that is. We don't know that that's interesting. We're just like, cool, they won a prize. That's great. And now it's like, what? It won the grand jury prize at Sundance? That's insane. So then I get an interview magazine calls my house and is like, hey, we want to do a interview with you and come in and do a photo shoot. So they do this really cool photo shoot in New York and they do an interview with me from being in the movie. And literally Billy Lazarus from UTA in Los Angeles, one of the biggest, you know, agencies that there is, calls my house within a couple of months and says, hey, I want to represent you. And I'm like, I have an agent. I've heard about all these people being disloyal. This is bullshit. I don't know who you are, but don't call here again. And it's dumbest shit ever, not knowing anything about the industry whatsoever. And he was like, okay, look, but if I get like, has your agent given you any scripts? Like, do you know what's in the, there's a couple things that are really good for you right now. And I'm like, what do you mean scripts? I've seen a script once in my life. And he was like, no, I'll send you some scripts for things that I think are good. There's one called Thumbsucker. There's one called Empire Falls. There's one called this. And I'm like, okay, send them. I mean, maybe this guy's real. And he sends these things to me in the mail. I read them within 2 days, call him back. And I'm like, hey, I really like Thumbsucker. I really like Empire Falls. And he's like, oh shit, you read them already? Look, if your agent isn't doing this for you and you're going to miss these things. So I give my agent a chance. I'm like, hey, have you seen Personal Velocity? It turns out he hasn't even seen it and like isn't in that world at all. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to transfer. And then Billy takes over. I never meet the guy. He sends me, he's like, look, if you guys just spend like $500, you get a plane ticket to Los Angeles, I will set you up with so many auditions. And this, at this time, it is just a wave of independent film that I don't know is happening, but it is. And it's independent film, especially for my age group. I mean, I went on 15 auditions in 3 days in Los Angeles, the 10 auditions and 5 general meetings. And it was absolutely insane. And I ended up booking Thumbsucker from that 3-day experience in Los Angeles on my first plane trip ever out of New Jersey.
Wow. So you get catapulted. You do this job on this random audition after a year of trudging in and out through the Port Authority bus terminal in New York. And you do this job that you sort of, you say is like, just leaves you with this feeling of like, that was weird. I just had to pretend like I was crying and itching myself till I scabbed over. And 2 years later, you hear it gets an award and an agent, big agent calls your home, and then you're catapulted into Hollywood. And then you come out to Hollywood and you book a movie like Thumbsucker starring Keanu Reeves and Vince Vaughn. And was Charlize Theron in that movie too?
No. Tilda Swinton is the mom.
Tilda Swinton. That's it. And so
Vincent D'Onofrio, Benjamin Bratt, Keanu Reeves, who I, you know, obviously everybody knows Keanu Reeves. And I was just, That was the one I was blown away by. I was like, oh my God, he's going to be my dentist. He's going to have his fingers in my mouth. This is the weirdest shit in the world.
And what is that like? What is that whole experience for you? I mean, if you go from, you know, when you tell us like every time going into New York, it costing $50, it felt like you were stealing from your family for this endeavor. If you didn't come back successful, if you didn't come back with a job. So now is that just like the weight of the world off your shoulders when Thumbsucker happens or how do you feel?
Oh yeah. Just full success, but also complete fear. Just real, true, honest fear. Because I know from that one experience that I had what acting is, but I don't know how to always get there and always pull it off and always trick myself correctly. All I knew was that I had an emotional girlfriend experience, like where she broke up with me and it was so emotional, all this stuff. And in Thumbsucker, the audition scene was this breakup with a girlfriend thing. And I get to Los Angeles and I'm there for a day already. I've already gone on a couple auditions. I'm in a waiting room for an hour to audition for Thumbsucker. And they bring me down this weird basement hallway and I get to the end of it. And then Mike Mills is sitting in a chair. He's the director. And he's like, okay, do it. And we do the audition. And he's like, okay, I don't know how to say this, but could you stop acting? And then my like shoulders sort of slink and my fear goes away. And I'm like, yeah, I can. You want to try that? He's like, yeah. So then I just say the words and it just works better. And he's just happy as shit. And then they bring in, enter Kelly Garner, who's like, you know, 16, but she looks friggin' 25, you know, hot as hell. And I'm like, oh God. I'm 17 years old and she's playing the girl who's going to like dump me. And I seriously cried my eyes out that in the audition. I was like, oh baby, don't do it. Just like, I was there. It really felt terrible. And it, I don't know. It's just one of the weirdest experiences I ever had.
I love how that there's this really deep emotional journey to your life as a kid actor that leads you to these weird basement rooms where you find yourself overly emotional in a way that makes little to no sense to you, but that you're willing to just go along the ride for. And when you come out of it, it works out and you get to work on really cool stuff. It's just like a really good recurrence that seems to happen throughout your career as a kid actor. Oh my and God. When you look back at all these things now as an adult, and obviously with all the knowledge and experience that you have as an adult actor, like, do you look back fondly at these things? Are they just weird and hysterical? Like, what is your, like,
I don't know. To me, it sounds hysterical right now. It sounds like a joke. It does. Yeah. It does. And when you say catapulted, I mean, that's seriously what happened. I never really thought of it that way, though. It's weird how your brain can just make things normal, how humans are just such adaptable creatures, because I just didn't know how fucking weird all this shit was while it was happening. And really, you know, even now, until I see your guys' perspective on it, and it's like, yeah, that was nuts. I guess that was fucking nuts. But at the time, it just felt like this is what's supposed to happen. I've done some work. It's paying off. And this is how it works here. And you just go and you work your ass off as fast as possible. And if you're in the right place at the right time and you can get there in your head and trick yourself right, you can just get a job that blows your whole world apart. And that's what happened constantly. And once started, I mean, Thumbsucker started, I was now the indie darling character actor thing that they used for everything. I ended up getting the first two scripts that were ever sent to me were Thumbsucker and Empire Falls, and I got them both. So I went from Thumbsucker straight to from Portland, Oregon to Portland, Maine, where now a month later I'm doing a shoot up a school thing where I'm a school shooter in Maine doing an HBO mini series with like Ed Harris and all these, you know, Dennis Farina and Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward and all these people and Philip Seymour Hoffman. What I experienced, I can't even put into words because it doesn't happen today.
Is there a point here, Lou, where you start to feel like you belong, or this whole time are you feeling like you're an outsider and you're just going to be figured out at some point?
I feel like I can't answer that question because I don't know. I was afraid I might be an outsider, but I really thought if I just believe in this shit, it seems to be working out.
I think that's probably the feeling from most people in the entertainment industry as your workload increases or as you, you know, when you find yourself on the set of something demanding, I guess might be the right word. But I have a question, you know, because I think I really relate to you in the sense of, you know, when you talked about working with Rebecca Miller and that Daniel Day is hanging out with your dad. For me, a lot of my life growing up as a kid actor, if I got to work with some really cool people, some people now as an adult that would really intimidate me or that I really respect or look up to.
Right.
As a kid, I had no idea. Like they could, it was craft service and Daniel Day. Who knows? Yeah. Who knows?
It was naive. I didn't care. It was totally, totally innocent.
So for you going all of a sudden having to show up these sets working with Keanu Reeves and Vince Vaughn and Paul Newman and Ed Harris, are you aware of who these people are and their careers? Or are you just, it's just another set, you're really ingrained in the part. Like what's your experience on the actual set of these things?
My dad was he's the kind of guy that watches a movie and can tell you every single person in the cast. For some reason, he just had an affinity for people's faces and names. And so he could tell you everybody. So he would tell me the story of each person. He'd be like, oh my God, Ed Harris from this and that. You know what I mean? He would explain it to me. And so it felt like I was making my dad happy for sure. And I could feel like the legend of these people through my dad's words, but I had never seen any movies with them in it, except Ed Harris. I remember knowing him from Creepshow because that was one of my first movies I ever watched when I was a kid, Creepshow.
Yeah. But when you show up to meet Ed Harris or perform with Ed Harris, are you intimidated by this or is it just exciting or how do you remember feeling?
I was a little intimidated for sure. Just because, I mean, Ed Harris is one of the most stoic people I've ever met in my whole life.
He tried to be nice to that guy. A stoic marble statue.
He tried to be nice to him and he's just like, yep. Uh-huh. And you're like, oh boy, I don't know what I got into just now. I should not say anything else. But yeah, I don't know. I remember when I got to set for Empire Falls, my plane was late and then the car was late from the plane to the middle of Waterville, Maine. And Paul Newman was a producer on this thing and I didn't know who that was. I had never seen a Paul Newman movie in my life. So this guy, I get finally to the rehearsal. I'm an hour late and that looks like shit. I feel like an idiot. And this old man, this scrungy old man comes up to me with the
brightest. He's never been described like that ever.
ever. You're the first person
to call Newman
scrungy.
Looks
like a homeless guy. And he comes up to me with the brightest blue eyes I ever seen in my life. And he goes, you're not going to really shoot up a school now, are you? I'm like, no. And he goes, all right. He kind of wanders away. And I was like, I think
back
that
to
was
my
Paul
salad
Newman.
Dressing.
So, Lou, early on, you were talking about how you felt like at 27, you were no longer in connection with this young person that was achieving all of these miraculous things where you described yourself as feeling most like yourself from 15 to 17.
Yeah,
is now kind of being on the other side of that and looking back, do you feel like you've reintegrated yourself with this younger version, this, you know, where you were seeing all the success early on in Sundance and doing that?
Yeah. I mean, there's been so many different phases for me. Like there was a point somewhere around 22. I mean, around honestly 2008 when I moved to Los Angeles and the recession hit and the SAG strike happened and everything just went downhill. That moment when I moved to Los Angeles, like the worst time ever. Somewhere around there when I was getting jobs still because I was still the indie darling. So even though nothing was happening, if there was something, I would still get the audition and I could still scrounge up a couple of small parts. From it, I was learning that I didn't need to take acting so seriously. The things that I had done at the beginning, like Personal Velocity, it was all crying and drama and sad and the really emotional, empathetic child. And then somewhere in there, I started to learn to actually have fun. And that changed everything. It was like I started to realize, oh, I think as an audience member, I notice when an actor has fun through their eyes. And I think if I don't have that fun, I'm not very entertaining to watch. I've seen some things now that I've done where if I would have had more fun, I would have had a better time. And I think the audience would have had a better time. And so I think I learned
that phase of it. I don't know how that answers your question at all, but that was a different thing. That was a major change that happened to me where finally I realized like, I have to have a good time doing this. This is not just a job. This is not just a profession. I have to have a good time or else it actually doesn't work.
Yeah. I'm kind of noticing like these interest, and correct me if I'm wrong, just an observation, these interesting phases where you're acting to help the family. This is a major motivation for you. And then this career starts happening for yourself. It just kind of surprises you as much as anybody else. And then you're almost acting to keep that career alive and keep those things going. And if now it sort of feels like you're acting for yourself at this point, not for your career.
Right around that time was the first moment I felt like I had to make a decision. Like, it doesn't look like everything's going to work out real easy anymore. The recession happened. SAG is struck. The writer's struck. It's harder now. I have to actually want this if I want to do it. And so I had to choose to do it, even though it was going to be harder. And now I was in a bigger, age group with a lot more people who wanted the same parts. And so it felt like a choice finally at that time.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
So we have two things, Lou, that we like to ask everybody that comes on. One of which is, if you had a couple of little Lou Taylor Poochies running around and they came to you with the desire to be an actor, what would your answer be to them?
I'm scared.
I'm scared too. I'm frightened.
I'm scared. No, I mean, my first answer is 100%. I would totally love for them to get into this stuff. I think it's ridiculous that I have that answer because I've gone through the weirdest experience of my life. And there are some people who are just not going to want to do this stuff. I mean, it's not in their wheelhouse or it's not in their genes to want to constantly compete. I guess I like that shit. And if they liked that shit, I wouldn't stop them.
Cool. Yeah, not everybody's going to be asked to cry, scratch themselves silly, and pretend like they're bleeding and not look anybody in the eye and say, okay, yeah, I can get down with that. So that makes sense.
If that's what they're happy about, like, that's the coolest thing ever. Like, great. I mean, at least I have some wisdom to impart and some advice.
I can tell you.
Because if you want to be like a lawyer, I'm not going to be able to help you.
Yeah, if you want C++ to be on Wall Street, yeah, you're just going to have to send them back to that school in Jersey. You got nothing exactly. For them. That's cool. So this is the last question we like to ask. When you came of age, when you turned 18, I know you said that your parents weren't storing away the money you were making as you were making it, but you must have had a Coogan account. And so when you turned 18 and you got that Coogan account money, what'd you do with it?
Well, I didn't get a Coogan account. I never even heard of that before AJ was talking to me about it, because I know you guys must have experienced that, but I didn't get paid that much, honestly, for anything that I did. I never did a TV show that was like a regular reoccurring payment system.
But not even for being on Broadway, not even doing The Sound of Music? You didn't have a Coogan account?
No, there was no Coogan account thing for that either. I was like 12 years old. I mean, honestly, I don't think any money would have gone into it. I think so much of it went toward transportation and then just like eating in New York and shit like that. Like, I didn't save much. I got to get like a TV. I got to do some cool things, but it was all going right out the window.
Maybe it's theater. Maybe theater is the way around the Coogan account. Maybe it's
The kids have to work
film and television.
Kids have to work 7 days a week, do 8 shows a week.
Yeah, exactly.
No Coogan account. That's like, that's
no
not
Coogan account. We're not going to ensure you guys save anything for these children.
No, when I was 18, I didn't get shit.
That's it. Well, there we go. Well, Lou, it's really awesome to hear your life, man. We love you. We just think you're such a great person. You know what else we're really excited about? We know you've had like such great work as an adult. We know you worked on You, an American Horror Story, and AJ told me you're going to be on a cool new HBO show. And so hearing you talk about sort of reconnecting with this youthful time in your life as a young actor and it bearing really good results for you makes us incredibly happy. And we're super excited to get to know you better and hear about this part of your life today. And thank you so much, dude.
Oh, dude, thanks. This is really fun. I mean, not the part where I'm talking about myself, but actually just talking to you guys about this stuff, because AJ told me that you guys did interview yourselves for the first two episodes or something. And I'm really excited to hear that, because
more than telling my story, it would really be interesting to me to find out your guys' story, to John Foster's story, some of my best friends, Trevor's story that I have never heard. I've never known what they did to get into this thing, but we all did it and we all went our weird separate route.
Exactly. I think everybody's got stories that are very similar and also incredibly different. And we that's one main catalyst for this podcast, was we realized that these stories kind of live and die with all of us. And we just wanted to put them out there before they disappear into oblivion.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. Well, good luck. I hope you just keep doing it.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for adding to it, man. We love this chapter of it. And thank you so much, everyone, for listening.
Guys, wasn't that great? You got to meet the pooch. Awesome.
You met the pooch. Isn't
what a guy.
He's so charming. We're so glad to share him with you guys. We are going to have him back, actually, because after we recorded this, he ended up telling us some other stories. We all hung out and we were like, why wouldn't you tell us that stuff? He's like, great stories. Okay, next time. Next time we'll get him. Yeah.
Why do you do that voice for the pooch? You do the same voice for me.
That's the voice. I do that voice for everybody. That's the voice of anyone else I ever talk to. That's it. You don't want
to come up with a voice for you.
Go ahead. What does it sound like?
Kind of. I was thinking of like a bully voice. It's you cackling at me while we're playing ping pong.
That's exactly
maniacal laugh is all I.
Yeah, that's AJ in like an 80s, one of those 80s floating across the screen memories when you just see a face floating across the screen. That's me just cackling and smacking and just smacking,
circling around my head
straight into your face. Exactly. Okay, guys, listen, next week we are going to give you guys our season one finale. It's just me and AJ hanging out and talking about all kinds of interesting stuff, more about us and our story,
We should ask people if you have questions for us. Please send in questions. That would be great.
Send in
some listener questions.
That sounds awesome. And also, it's not really a season one. There's no seasons. Someone made that point. I was like, yeah, I know.
I like that there's seasons. I personally like that there's seasons.
I know. Because AJ thinks he's going to get into syndication by season seven or something. He's a former child actor. This is what happens. What we're just doing is just taking a little hiatus. And then we've gotten some awesome guests that are going to come on for next year. So we're just scheduling everybody out and for this year. And we're really excited. And we're going to add, as we've mentioned, some video to this. So you get to see how disgusting and fat AJ got over the course of the last 20 years. That's
really looking forward to that. And you get to see all my reaction faces to
you get to see him cringing all the time like that. Like, don't say that. Don't say that.
I'm cringing right now.
I know. Exactly. Yeah. I know. AJ was like, don't call me that. Don't say that's offensive. We're going to get canceled. Just don't do that. Anyway, guys, we really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much once again. If you could see AJ's face right now, you're going to love it. When you see AJ, you're going to love it, guys. It's going to be so great. It's just going to be – we're going to make little montages of AJ just smacking himself on the forehead over and over again, wondering why we're still friends. That's all we're going to do. Okay. If you liked us, what can they do for us, AJ?
They should rate us. They should
review us.
Share it with a friend. Tell your mom. Mm-hmm.
And also write us some questions. You got any questions for us? You're wondering how much weight AJ's gained in the last year in quarantine? Ask him. It's totally fine. I can't wait for you to see his face.